Good morning. I am lonely Jason Dome, familyless. Templetons are here as a family. The Carringtons are here as a family. And I have a lovely family, but you'll have to take my word for it. I'm not going to Turkey. So why in the world am I here? Well, it's sort of representative. My presence is representative that these are not self-sending men. There's a church behind each one of these men. And these are not fundraisers. So we do need funds. But these guys are going to be working on missionary work. I'm sure you've all known at some point in your life a missionary who was forced into the role of spending a lot of time fundraising. Our churches have decided we're having none of that. If we're going to send missionaries, they're going to be missionaries. And we're going to carry the ball on the fundraising side. So in sort of introducing what we're doing here today, I'd just like to say four quick things, and then I'll get out of the way and you can hear directly from the missionaries. If you can see a screen, this is really what all this is about. There is hope for sinners in the Lord Jesus Christ. There are masses in Turkey who can live and die a whole lifetime, never know a Christian, never hear the gospel. And so, you know, we're drowning in the goodness of God and the gospel here, and so we have to do something about that. So that's what this is about. So I'd like to say four things, and then I'll get out of the way very quickly. Number one, I'm here representing two elder teams. Sovereign Redeemer has three elders. Two of three are here today. One's going to Turkey. Hope Baptist has three elders. One here is today, and two are back in Wake Forest. And so I'm representing our two elder teams on behalf of two churches who are delighted to send two families to Turkey. So I don't know how your church government works around here, but to be an elder in our churches actually requires a supermajority to vote for you. So essentially, we're putting two men before you today who have had a supermajority of our members say, we want you to lead. Okay, we've heard you preach, and we've been observing your life, and we want you to lead us. Let me tell you a little bit about our two churches. We're a lot like you. Actually, the church that I serve is almost exactly like you in terms of how I heard you described by Rick Hensley last night. We're about 110 people if everybody comes. And we're a very enthusiastic lot, but we're not mega anything. We're not mega in people. We're not mega in resources. So as a consequence, we need help. Here's what we say about that. Good. We're glad we need help. We don't want to work our lives on things that are small enough that we're sufficient for. And we want to work on things that are bigger than us, that are beyond us. And we think it's a blessing for churches to band together and pool our resources. Our tagline is hold the rope. It's a tagline that comes from William Carey being sent to India. If you're familiar with William Carey, he's known as the father of modern missions. And if you didn't know better, you would think this was sort of a heroic tale of one man who went and sort of conquered the frontiers. That is not the story of William Carey at all. It's actually the story of a group of men and women who bonded themselves together in Christian friendship to do more than any of them could have done separately. And they really kept their faithfulness to one another over the course of a lifetime, supporting William Carey, who was the face of that missions movement in India. But behind the face of the movement, there were lifelong Christian friends who were holding the rope. William Carey said, I'll go down into the pit if you'll hold the rope. And they did. They held the rope for a lifetime. So we're looking to sort of build a coalition of lifelong Christian friends and churches to do that. Our elder teams have undertaken to spearhead our supporting these families. And so They come on trips like this, but the rest of our elder teams who are not going to Turkey are actually the ones who are spending a lot of time to pull together support for this. So that's number one. I'm here representing two elder teams on behalf of two churches who are delighted to send these two families to Turkey. Number two, we're sending old guys. Sorry, Paul and Michael. They were gonna figure it out sooner or later. Here's what I mean by that. They've been husbands for a long time. They've been fathers for a long time. We don't wonder whether a wife will flourish under their leadership or not, and we don't wonder whether children will flourish under their leadership a lot. We've got two congregations that said, yes, we see that you're qualified men to be elders because of how you conduct yourself in your home. These are qualified husbands and fathers. These are evangelists. These are preachers. These are local church shepherds. And that's really who we want to send, is men with gray hair who have just a variety of life experiences that are going to serve them well on the mission field. That's number two. We're sending old guys. Number three, we're sending missionaries. We're not sending aspiring missionaries. We're actually sending two families that have significant missions experience. They're going to be talking about it, but Michael and Brooke spent 2 years in Syria and Lebanon, sometimes on one side of that border and sometimes on the other side of that border, but both in the same Middle East region, and then spent almost 4 years in Hong Kong. So they know what they're getting into. Paul and Melinda have spent almost a year in Kenya and then a year in the Dominican Republic, facing all the associated challenges. So all that to say, we're not sending starry-eyed idealists. There's nothing wrong with starry-eyed idealists. Praise God for them. But when you're sending to the front lines where you have, in an overwhelmingly Islamic context, you want people who know what they're about, who have some scar tissue that has taught them some things, these are the families that we're sending. So we're sending missionaries, not aspiring missionaries. And then finally, we're sending to the front lines. Frontline missions are the places where there's very little penetration of the gospel. So you're going to hear sort of percentages and statistics. But overwhelmingly, Turkey is unreached. Those places are unreached for real reasons, because it's hard to be there. It's not stable there. If it wasn't hard and if it was stable, there would be a lot of Christian influence there already. It's higher risk missions. And this is why you have two families before you today and not one family. We've done a lot of homework, spoken to a lot of missionaries, and we've become convinced that what you see, really, if you start looking for it, what you see all over the New Testament is the principle of two by two, making missions sustainable in the long term. You give yourself an opportunity to see it be lasting work if you send two that can encourage each other and strengthen each other. John 10:16, this is right out of the mouth of Jesus. Other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. We're in dead earnest convinced that Jesus' voice is going to be heard if we faithfully send people to preach the gospel, that they'll hear his voice, he'll see to it, and that he'll be bringing sinners into his fold.
My name's Michael Templeton. Jason's already mentioned that. I'm going to start off our time, but disclaimer, apologies for my nasally sinuses, and I have to blow my nose this morning. Apologies. So anyways, with that out of the way, highlighting our prior missions experience, Jason's already mentioned that Paul and I in our families. We both have experience on the mission field, and that's part of what we want to highlight in the next couple of slides. Our first overseas missions experience as a family was spent in Syria and Lebanon. We started out in Damascus, Syria. Remember being drove across the border from Beirut. We landed in Beirut the day before 9/11, and they put the freeze on us. We thought we were going to get sent back. And after waiting in Beirut for a while, our supervisor with the IMB, the missions board of the Southern Baptist, drove my wife and I and Malachi, about as big as Sophia, our little six-month-old, and dropped us off in Damascus, set us up in a rented flat, and said, see you later. So that was, you know, our introductions to foreign missions. We spent 2 years in the Middle East. 1 year was spent in Damascus. We started feeling a huge need for mentoring for someone that had been there longer. So that's what took us to Lebanon. We left Damascus and went and lived in close proximity to a Canadian family in southern Lebanon, among a Shiite population right down there on the border of Israel and Lebanon. So in terms of our time there, we, as Jason said, some scar tissue from things that we've learned. You know, not all mistakes that we learned in terms of things that will come to bear on our mission in Turkey. There definitely is that. So where we're going, how we're going, how we're going about things, much of that's flowing out of shared experiences that Paul and his family and my family had in both deployments for us as well as for them. We spent a lot of time around Muslim peoples, as you can see on the slide there. If you didn't know who my wife was, she's kind of plucked down there in the middle with her head covered. So it was completely Muslim. This family here, I think we were the first foreigners to ever be in their home. Really spent most of our time studying foreign language, Arabic, while we were there. That was the permit that I was on. I was a student there. So the time in Syria and Lebanon was part of a 2+2 program where I was finishing a seminary degree. So the exit from Syria and Lebanon, you may wonder, you know, why'd you leave after 2 years? The departure was planned. We were there for 2 years, but the plan was to go back after we came back and graduated and went through that process. So the next spot was Hong Kong. We came back from Syria and Lebanon to graduate, and felt like the Lord was leading us to go back to the mission field, but as tent makers. So this is one of the other lessons learned in why we're doing, at least part of why we're doing what we're doing in Turkey. We want to stay laser focused on gospel ministry after learning the language, evangelism, discipleship, and church planting versus being employed, whether part-time or full-time. Turkey is not a place that we have to gain employment in order to live there, at least not right now. So we went to Hong Kong wanting to be employed full-time as tent makers, but still working with the local churches there, either to revitalize a church or to plant a new church. And one of the take-home lessons in Hong Kong was that if you're employed full-time, guess what? You work full-time, and you work a lot. So that's feeding into our going to Turkey and desiring not to go and tent make in Turkey so we can stay focused on that. It was both experiences were very profitable. We're employing practices in going to Turkey, like I've said, based out of the experiences that we've had in the Middle East and Hong Kong. And for us, the Middle East, some of you last night asked why Turkey. Our time in Syria and Lebanon just stamped a un, removable stamp on our hearts to preach the gospel to Muslim people groups. So that's a huge influence in our life, and it's feeding into why we're going to Turkey, at least in terms of our family. And I think Paul's going to talk about their experiences in the Dominican and Kenya.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Michael. So both myself, my wife, at the time we had Hannah and Naomi. Hannah's now 20, Naomi's just turned 19. So you can kind of get the idea here. They're in the front row, pictured when they were just little kids. And we went to Kenya. I often say it was kind of the result of maybe reading one missionary biography too many. We ended up going to Kenya, but we ended up going right out into the bush in the middle of absolute nowhere, where some people had never even seen people our complexion or anything like that. There were times when they would touch the girl's hair. They couldn't believe the texture of that. It was just a different place. But we went there, and we would spend our time in this village. It's called Lake Bogoria, and there's this tiny little village that's based there and then surrounded with huts as far as you could see, going up into the hills and mountains. So I would just spend my time each day going out with a young man or two and go to hut, sit down, talk to the family about Christ. There was really no basis or very much of a basis at all of Christianity, so you're really starting from scratch. But really, in that place, there's no such thing as an atheist. Everyone believed there is a god or gods, some sort of animism on the one side, and on the other side, sin was everywhere, drunkenness and all sorts of other problems, but the way to be saved from sin was just obviously something they had never really heard. And so we spent a lot of time just doing that and planted a little church there. But we ended up, after just the difficulty, and I think one of the mistakes I made, I jumped right into ministry almost immediately, get to the village, start having Sunday services, and rushed in and just didn't really take time to stabilize and really kind of make sure everyone was situated. So that was definitely something I think I learned or tried to take away from that. And so we were there in 2005 and 2006, went back to Canada. That's, by the way, where we're from. And then in 2012, we moved to the Dominican Republic. So going from a really super, super rural setting to a setting that was more in a city or an urban area, working in a slum, or what they call a barrio, in Santiago, which is basically, it's the second largest city in the Dominican Republic. So we just did the same exact same thing. Instead of going hut to hut, you were going from kind of corrugated shack to shack and doing the same thing, just talking to folks about Christ and about the Lord, a very much a Catholic country where people really haven't heard much of the gospel in some of these places. There are good churches down there, but by no means an unreached place by any stretch of the imagination. And so that was really the idea, the focus. That's all we really spent our time doing. And but again, the difficulty of really not having another family, and again, just a lot of different complexities, things I would take on as really my mistakes, a lot of them, things that we hope to learn from and go forward on. And yet at the same time, you see just the goodness of God as well, and the beauty of the gospel, the more that you speak it. Some of you probably have that experience when you talk to people who just don't know Christ, and as you're hearing your own voice speaking about the amazing grace of God, it just kind of kindles in your heart afresh a passion for God. So that was one of the great takeaways in the midst of a lot of pain and difficulty. And so we ended up not going back to Canada, but we ended up going back to going to North Carolina, and that's where we've been for the last 6 years or so.
The other thing Jason's alluded or spoken to was the relationship that we have to our local churches. Paul and I both are serving as elders in two different churches, Hope Baptist, and I'm serving with Jason and another man at Sovereign Redeemer. Again, this is to highlight what we hope to be a benefit to the stability to folks that will be engaged with us in Turkey is, you know, the prior missions experience and then local church pastors. Because of the nature of the work, frontline missions, church planting work, we're committed and convinced that sending local church elders to plant churches is critical. So we've tried to spend quite a bit of time. This picture's actually from the second time that we mm-hmm. spent together at the beach. You know, one thing that both families are very aware of is one of the main casualties on the mission field among team members is the fact that you're a team and we're all sinners. And so over and over again, we've been told by other missionaries, I think we both had prior missions experience with this, is solidify the relationships among the teams. And so we've been trying to do that ever since we've made the commitment, and the elders were in agreement to start spending lots of time so that the fewer surprises are coming up when we're in Turkey. So we're trying to spend, we spent a week together here, and we've done that twice, and we're regularly together. So the Lord's growing both our families as we get to know each other more. But ascending local church elders, as Jason has said, is another critical piece to what is making up the work.
We've talked a little bit about ourselves, and now we want to talk just about, well, what are we going to be doing? What is the mission? Just by the way, for the kids, this might be something interesting. So where is Turkey? Which number? You guys have 10 seconds. Which one of them is Turkey? Our kids can't guess. Who said that? Oh, you got it. 9. Good. Good guess. So number 9 is Turkey. So this number here, 1 out of 30. 1 out of 30 represents, if you've got 30 missionaries going out into the field, one of them is actually going to the unreached. Think about that just in terms of the quantity. You know, that's one of the just staggering numbers. And then when you think about it, one out of these 30 missionaries are actually going to the front lines, to the unreached people. 1 out of 10 of those are actually going to be involved in evangelism, church planting, discipleship, that kind of thing, versus administrative. So you can kind of get a sense of just the vast emptiness. So though there's a lot of missionary work going on in the world, it's not a lot going on, I think, as Jason mentioned earlier, in some of these difficult, very, very difficult places. And so you're familiar, I think, with Turkey. If you open up your Bible, you're already familiar with it. It's the place where the ark rested in the days of Noah. When you flip over to the New Testament, it's where the Apostle Paul is from. If you read Revelation, it's where all those 7 churches are. A huge amount of the New Testament takes place in Turkey, right? You know about Ephesus, and you've heard of Lydia, who's a seller of purple from Thyatira. So all of these things you're familiar with. All the letters that were written to the Galatians, and where Peter talks about to the saints that are in Cappadocia, Bithynia, and all these different places. That's all taking place in Turkey. So Turkey's obviously it's somewhere kind of somewhere between, they say, the Middle East and Europe. I can't quite decide, but it's surrounded by, I think, about 7 countries. So on the European side, you have Bulgaria and Greece. And then when you go to the eastern side, you've got Syria, and you've got Iraq, Iran, Georgia, Armenia, these countries. And then, of course, on the top, the Black Sea. So just by way of getting some bearings geographically. Here's one of the things when we talk about what the great, great need is for laborers in this part of the world. It's the 17th largest country in the world, and it's got a population of about 82 million people, actually, right now. It's the 8th largest Muslim country. And what's fascinating is that when you look at the percentages, right, you look at Turkey, it's 99.8% Muslim. You know, to be unreached, it classifies you need to, you know, have less than 2%. So they've got less than 0.2% of their people that are reached with the gospel. But then you look at other nations, like even Saudi Arabia has less concentration of Muslims, or Iraq or Afghanistan or some of these other places. And so Turkey, it's one of those places where it's just got a huge, huge concentration. And I have some numbers there for you. And any of you who might know the history, there were more Christians, obviously, at one point. They had some major problems. There was genocide and all sorts of things in the early 1900s, were somewhere between not only 1 million Armenians, but maybe 3 to 4 million Christians. And that falls under the auspice of all sorts of, you know, Eastern Orthodox and all sorts of things the Lord knows. But basically weeded out almost every Christian that was there, so that by 1960, evangelical-wise, there was really only one known Christian in that country. Now, God knows if there were more, but that's really, talking to missionaries there, that's really the state of what they understood. Well, 10 years later, that man's son, he got converted and came to Christ. So now you've got 2 Christians, not 200, but not 2 churches, but 2 Christians by 1970, and then by 1980, you've got about 25, and then this 1988, you've got about 80 Christians in this entire nation, less than probably the people just gathered here, but scattered all around the country. Well, today, there's about 2,000 to 5,000 Christians that are in the entire country. So among 82 million people, you know, it's like 0.007% or something like that, just unbelievably small quantity. So the need is immense. And we just put this, wanted to share this out. This is some friends that we know, we've got to know over time. He's actually a great resource. His name is Glenn. His wife's name is Sonia. They're in a city right now. Actually, they're just moving. I just talked to him or exchanged WhatsApp with him yesterday. He's in a town called Eskişehir, and he's just moved him and his wife to Kütahya, which is the name of the city that they're in right now. And he got there about 2 years ago, Glenn and his wife, and learned Turkish, and now they are literally planting a church of about 10 people in Kütahya. It basically came out of this college group where two students went to Turkey, talked to people about the Lord, and eight of them, you know, came over the course of time to know the Lord, and they're realizing we don't have the means to kind of shepherd them and so on, so they just kind of put it out there. And so Glenn and his wife are going to go there and begin a work, literally, like, it's just begun, probably a few months old, really. And so he sent us something that was interesting. He sends us out a newsletter. So just to give some context, so I mentioned he's from Eskişehir, that's where he was living. It's a population of about 900,000 people, almost a million people. Kütahya, over half a million people. Bilecik, 213,000. Afyon, 708,000. Uşak, 350,000. You get a sense of these kind of massive cities. And then when you take a look at it, and by the way, you know Phrygia, right? Phrygia is in the Bible, of course, as well. It's still named that. This is what happens, right? In a city of 900,000 people, almost a million people, Eskişehir has the greatest concentration of Christians. So there's about 50 people in Eskişehir that know the Lord, that actually are a part of a church. There's about four known churches. So when you've got a church of 40 people or 50 people or a church like this, this would be like a mega church in a country like Turkey. They just don't have big, big groups of people, right? And so there's about 15 families laboring there already in this area of Eskişehir. And then you just look down the line, like Kütahya, 571,000 people, but they've got 15 Christians in that entire city. Or, you know, you can kind of look at it. Afyon has almost 800,000 people, 0 to 10 Christians. It's phenomenal to really kind of consider these numbers and so on. So just to kind of put it in that context of the need to not only be involved in missions, but in places where the gospel really isn't, and where even where there are missionaries, sometimes it might be kind of two tiers back from actually going out. As Michael mentioned, our entire intention is to go out and preach the gospel by whatever means the Lord would provide, not only to evangelize, but to disciple, and then by God's grace, it's all in God's hands, but to plant a biblical church. So that's really our entire intention here. So Michael's going to talk a little bit about what happens, what's happening now, as well as when we get there in the initial period.
Yeah, so right now, we've already mentioned, you know, both Paul and I are serving as local church pastors at our respective churches. We're both still fully employed. That'll be changing as of October 1. We'll no longer be employed with our current employment. Paul works for a tech firm, and then I work in real estate. We're working on wrapping that up right now. But as of October 1, we'll be supported by the funds from Hold the Rope. We're both working on language. Our families are working on language. The kids, there's resources, live tutors, like native speakers. Yesterday morning before we left, my son Malachi was on a video feed from Istanbul with a common tutor that, you know, Paul and I and he use, and the ladies have tutors as well the same way. And more apps than you can shake a stick at in terms of filling in blank, you know, void time during the day. So the goal there is to lay as much of the foundation as possible, but the first 2 years will be dedicated to language learning. Neither one of us are wanting to get in country and be able to speak enough to get around and then get carried away doing, you know, ministry. Not that either one of us are going to be like, sorry, we can't talk to you about the gospel until, you know, the 2-year mark, but the focus of how are we structuring our time on a daily basis once we get in country. Our families are both here, so it's the work is ample in terms of what we're doing right now. Both our homes are on the market. Paul beat me to contract, so his house is under contract. My house is on the market, so if anybody's looking to relocate for work to North Carolina, I have a house I can sell you. So, and the closer we get to moving to Turkey, we'll be, you know, starting to identify potential homes that we'll go and visit probably the next day after we get there and we wipe the sleep out of our eyes. So that's what we're doing now leading up to November the 19th. The tickets have been bought, if you don't know that. We bought those several months ago. Once we're in country, Paul's mentioned already, we do want to be mindful of the needs of ourselves and our families, to tend to kind of settling in, getting set up, getting our homes established. We'll be doing full-time language learning. Another thing that Paul and I both want to do differently in Turkey is give our wives ample time to learn the language. Learning the language once we're there is, in our minds, we're just critical to the long-term stability of us living there and making Turkey our new home. And we see, not just for ourselves, but for our wives, not to be, you know, imagine sitting around in a conversation at somebody's house and you're always on the outside, not really knowing all that's happening and being talked about. So Paul and I are going to take on not a new responsibility, but we're going to be a little more hands-on when it comes to the homeschooling, so that we can give our wives at least 4 hours every day, just like we're going to give ourselves opportunity to learn the language while we're there in country. So, and not just the wives, but the kids. Especially our younger children, you know, they'll run circles around us and probably be doing some translating work for us initially as they'll pick up the language early. There's a pastor on the ground, so we're not going there and have no believers to fellowship with. Fikret Bocek is a Turkish pastor that we've had a relationship with for quite some time. He's a Presbyterian pastor. We'll be fellowshipping with him and attending their church services. You know, you could probably go there apart from the Turkish, and it's on the eighth floor. I think it's the eighth floor of a kind of industrial-type setting. Services pretty normal to what we're used to, a fellowship meal after the service. So we will have fellowship, Christian fellowship there. We're very thankful. That's part of the softer landing in Turkey and Izmir in particular. And not just for the Christian fellowship, but also to learn from Fikret the first couple of years. And I'm sure, you know, well past that, we'll go with Fikret and learn from him. This is a Turkish man that knows the Lord. And Paul and I are not naive or, you know, overly confident to think that, you know, we're going to go in there and, you know, show people how, you know, how this is done. When we were there in April, we went on a 10-day exploratory trip, Paul, myself, Malachi, and then Scott Brown, and we went out with him one day into this marketplace, sitting around drinking tea and popping olives like, you know, it was popcorn, and watching him evangelize these Turkish men. So we look forward to more of that while we're over there from Fikret. And then post 2 years, as Paul said, we'll be working to shift the focus of our time to evangelism, discipleship, and as the Lord blesses the efforts of forming a local Reformed Baptist church there in Izmir. I believe now Jason's going to talk about the holding the rope.
By the way, if you want to get back to information, holdtherope.org has a summary of everything that we're talking about, a way to get in touch with us, a way to throw money at us. So holdtherope.org is sort of the repository for all of this. So support.
That's up.
Okay. We have really two numbers that we are tracking closely. One is the deployment fund. The other is the ongoing monthly support. So I'll just tell you what the target is and where we are with both of those. For the deployment fund, our target is $250,000. Why? Well, that encompasses two main things. One is the money to get two large families over there and to get them settled for long-term living. That means places rented, those places furnished, vehicles purchased so they have a method of transportation. That is about $112,000 of the $250,000 target. What's the rest? It is a pre-accumulation of 10 months of monthly support. In other words, we are really trying to keep ourselves out of a situation where we're raising in January what they need in February. That's sort of a pressure cooker that we would like not to be in. Secondly, 10 months pre-accumulation of monthly support gives you an emergency fund in case there's a political or medical crisis that would necessitate getting those families out quick and mobilize for them to be able to access significant funds to be able to respond to an unforeseen emergency. It just gives you resources to draw upon. So you can see, Tuesday, I think, was the day this week where we went over $200,000 raised towards that. And so it's not that we're taking our eye off of that, but at this point, with 3 months left till they go on support, I'll actually be really surprised if we don't get to the $250,000. So to that, I just want to say a big praise God. I think, you know, a year ago, we were at something like $30,000, and God has been raining money on us from directions that we never would have guessed or anticipated. And so we're just really encouraged. When you embark on something like this, you feel like you have a sense of the Lord for what you should be doing. But then the proof is, will God fund it? Okay, I mean, if God will not fund it, then the answer is really you were not hearing the Lord accurately because you don't have the ability to do it. So it looks like, hey, the Lord is funding this, which is a great encouragement to us. Secondly, the ongoing monthly support, we have a $14,000 per month requirement for these two families, $7,000 per month per family. And that allows them to be over there and not seek other employment, but to stay focused on evangelism, discipleship, and church planning, which is really what we want. And of that, we currently have $10,500 currently coming in. So right now, they get $0 support up until October 1st, and then their support starts. So right now, that $10,500 $100 is coming in from a variety of churches and individuals, and it's not people who are pledging to give, it's people who are already giving. It already comes in every month, so we're about 75% of the way there. In terms of who's supporting, there's obviously our two churches, Hope Baptist and Sovereign Redeemer, and then there are six other churches, North Carolina, Colorado, Wisconsin, Alabama, New Zealand, and one more that I can't remember. So anyway, churches all over the place, and we have a couple of other trips coming up. We're going to Wisconsin to visit a church that's already supporting, and we're going down to Alabama and Florida in August to visit some churches too. So pray for us and consider joining with us. Questions and answers. We'd really like to field questions. Yes?
It might be helpful for you two brothers just to share your conversion testimony for everybody, how you came to repent and put your trust in the Lord Jesus Christ. So maybe briefly hear your conversion testimony.
So Sam is asking for the testimonies of these two brothers.
Yeah, I came to know the Lord in college. Grew up in a Southern Baptist home where we were there every time the doors were opened, and And then I went home and carried on with life however I wanted to. So it was around 20 years old. I was playing football, and I had a good friend that wouldn't leave me alone, kept inviting me to these Fellowship of Christian Athletes meetings. And so I went to get him off my back and got saved. Yeah. So, and it was, you know, I didn't have to quit playing football, but I did. Lost all my friends. They thought I was a total weirdo, but got some real friends, and the rest is history. So that's how I came to know the Lord.
Yeah, I'll try to be as brief as I can, but I grew up in Toronto, in Canada, and it was a nominal, basically I went to a Catholic school, but, you know, would go to church maybe every 5 years or something like that. It was just no experience at all with the Lord or reading the Bible, obviously for obvious reasons, being in a Catholic setting. So I kind of went the same route. I was in university and just kind of playing sports, playing football, and long story short, I ended up, all the guys on my football team were bouncers at a nightclub, and even though I was too young, I ended up going to this nightclub, and they all, of course, let me in, and there is where I met my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and so that's where we met, in a nightclub of all places. She was dancing, and I was just there to, you know, nothing good, put it that way. And but we were there, and we started to get to know each other. Long story short, she ended up becoming a believer. It was a radical transformation in her life. So she came to know the Lord. Everything changed. And so as a 20-year-old thought I could overthrow Christianity, I got my hands, someone lent me a Bible. I'm going to dismantle Christianity. So I decided to, one night as I'm sitting in my room, let me open up this thing and see what it has to say. And opened it up to the Sermon on the Mount. And I'm sitting in my room listening to hip-hop music, and I start reading the Sermon on the Mount, and I couldn't believe it. I got really angry at first, because I saying out loud, how come nobody ever told me? Here I am, 20 years old, and this has been here the whole time. And I got upset and angry. I didn't know anything about God's sovereignty, of course. And so it was just one of those amazing experiences. I would pause and listen to the music, and then I would go back to read, and I'm like, what? Every single song is the same thing, different beat, but they're saying the same thing. And here I'm reading words I've never seen before. I want to know this man. That's kind of what I ended up saying. So that night I ended up taking all my, at that time it was 96, so you didn't have CDs. I don't think it was cassettes. And I got them all in a garbage bag and went across the street and dumped them in a garbage can at the basketball court, and went back and just began to devour the Bible and read. And from there, just, you know, that break of just seeing, no one told me, but it's like these two things can't go together. If I'm going to follow Christ, then I'm going to follow him. And same type of situation, lost your friends and family and all sorts of things. But, boy, I wouldn't exchange it. I always say to someone, if I were to be given just one life to live as a Christian or 1,000 lives to live as how I was living before, I wouldn't even blink. You know, just to live and to know Christ is really everything. So it's just really the mercy of God, and using my girlfriend at the time, and then we got married. That's about a year later. Just, you know, everything just changed, because your trajectory changes when you know the Lord. And so we got married young, at about 21, and the Lord has carried us through all sorts of ups and downs and everything else, but he's been faithful. So that's in a nutshell. Right. So the question is, as we were looking at the various slides, there was the slide I have up now just mentions, I think, about 6 different cities located in a province. So there's a number of provinces throughout Turkey, I think 81 provinces. So this is just one province. And the question, I think, is our plan to plant in these particular cities, or was it just to kind of give a general sense of the state of Christianity in those? And it was more to do with giving you a sense of the state of Christianity. So Phrygia is just a province north of where we're going to be initially, which is a province called Izmir. Izmir is about 10 million people, and then the main city in Izmir is about 4 million. It's actually called Izmir as well, so it's Smyrna in Revelation chapter 2. That's where we're going to be. But this just gives you a sense. You could probably extrapolate this here and apply it right across the entire nation. It gets actually more sparse as you go more east. So this is in the western part of Turkey. As you go further towards Syria and Iraq, Iran, and those kinds of countries, you get fewer and fewer and fewer Christians. Just because missionaries don't go there, it gets increasingly difficult. There's all sorts of other problems. So does that answer? This is, hopefully just gives a picture of really the state of Christianity.
Yeah, I'll restate and try to clarify, make sure I understand the question. So I think the question is, what's our plan to balance ministry life in Turkey with family life? Is that accurate? He's going to whack me over the head is one way. I mean, there is accountability. It's not just, you know, to lift me up when times is hard, but I'm going to take the same shortcomings to Turkey that I have now, so the accountability this brother will provide, if he sees things becoming disproportionate and me, you know, giving myself completely to ministry and letting my family shrivel and die on the vine there. So in terms of, you know, just out of the gate, planning to go in country and, you know, pass the baton for, you know, half the day right out of the gate is a way that we're looking to care for our wives and in be engaged with the children. I mean, guys that work full-time jobs, you know, in the congregation, you get home 5, 6 o'clock, you have, you know, a couple of hours of time before the little ones, if you have little ones, and they're going to bed. So, you know, my time with my family, if we hold to that, I mean, it'll double when we get into Turkey and caring for them. You know, one other way that we're not going to blush, and we hope the supporting churches won't have a problem with a respite. So that's another way. My wife has been really helpful to say, you know, we will need to take breaks. We can't stay in context and just grind away at it for 2 or 3 years without taking any breaks. So if you have, you know, ideas about missionaries that, you know, we won't come home for 20 years and take no vacations, well, that's not going to be these two. For the purpose of caring for our families. Another thing, and I'll give Paul a chance to speak to it, is Fikret Bocek is counseled us when we were there. He said, find something fun to do in Turkey as a family, whether that's going out to the seaside or hikes, or find fun things to do. So respite doesn't mean that we, you know, travel out of country, but there's routine family time where it's not just constant ministry. One other thing come to mind is Sundays. It'll be in Turkish, so there'll be another day of the week. We haven't decided which one it'll be that, you know, Paul and I will take turns feeding our families together, worshiping together in English, because initially, you know, we really won't get a whole lot out of the Sunday service, so.
I would just add, I mean, yeah, when we spoke last night, top of mind for me, I kind of hinted at it earlier, is that, you know, you hit the ground and you start running. So kind of knowing yourself, knowing your own tendency and proclivity to go and do that, I think is going to be, it's helpful, being kind of self-aware of that and then being able to kind of tether it back. This time also we have, I think, very good elder care, which is going to be different than what we've had in the past. men that are going to ask hard questions and ask, you know, what's going on in your family, or ask the wives. And I think that's going to be really, really helpful. And that way we can make adjustments versus just kind of keep going in a direction that might not be very healthy for the family. So that awareness of, I think, failure points in the past, I think it's invaluable. Michael mentioned about the language, but there's so many other things that I think we can do as men to help our families make those adjustments. It's going to be difficult for sure. We were talking about it last night, the Muslim call to prayer, hearing that, it's going to be very kind of disarming initially, probably fade to the background, but that's when you know you're in a different world and you're the minority at that point. So it's going to be, I'm sure, a bit of a road to just make sure we're kind of shepherding our families along the way properly. So, but we welcome questions and things along the way too. Yeah, okay, thank you.
So our two churches are going to stay highly engaged. So we're not sending them, hey, we got you on the plane, our job is done. We're marathoners. There's really nothing special about us other than we've shown the ability to keep going. And really, William Carey said that about himself. He described himself as a plodder. A plodder is just someone who's not particularly fast, but he keeps going left foot, right foot, left foot, right foot. And we're looking, honestly, looking for that in partner churches as well. We want marathoners, plodders. We think we're doing this 10 years from now. We think we're doing this 20 years from now. We're not sending them over and abandoning them. In fact, Paul's co-elders have signed up to be the ones who go over annually to provide care for these brothers and just be there on the ground, labor with them some, but really just to be an encouragement to them and their families annually, ongoing.
The question is, how open can we be evangelizing? I would say fairly open. Paul and I don't have any plans to be on the street corners preaching we do here sometimes. I don't think we'll be on the street corners either handing out tracts indiscriminately, but we will be meeting in open marketplaces, armed with Bibles and tracts and gospel literature. We will be intentionally setting aside days of the week where we're going out, you know, maybe with not an appointment, maybe one, but we plan to stay out and stay somewhere with the hopes of striking up, you know, more gospel conversations. So I think in the Muslim world, Turkey, it is unique in that aspect where evangelizing is not illegal for adults towards adults. Conversion is not illegal. It will cost the converts for sure, and maybe us, but those things are not against the law. So,
just by way of history, so the Ottoman Empire, you're probably familiar with it. That's where Turkey was, the Ottoman Empire, in 1924, kind of around that time it collapsed, and they had this new form of really a secular government came up. So it was still Muslim in terms of the population, but they instituted kind of more Western laws where it wasn't illegal to be a Christian or other things, what Michael was just sharing. So there's still a cultural challenge for sure, in that to be Turkish is to be Muslim. So that's a big, big thing, right? To kind of tear away from Islam is to say something's wrong with being Turkish, and it's a super, super nationalistic country. Like, you see more Turkish flags than you see American flags on July 4th, and that's just a regular day. They're just everywhere, so it's very much a proud nation in that regard. But, of course, you know, the Lord knows his sheep, and so that's what we're banking on, just preaching the word and hoping the Lord would call his people. The other thing is, because it's a different culture, it's a much more hospitable culture than even here, so having opportunities to have people into your home, you know, the families become invaluable at that point. You know, wives, talking with wives, or, you know, you're out at the park or in a market and your children, you know, people see your family, it's going to raise curiosity. You know, Michael's got 9 kids, that's an anomaly. We've got 6, I mean, it's different even there. So that's going to be, I'm sure, a conversation starter where you can just begin having those opportunities to meet with people and then get into their homes or have them also into our homes. So very much a hospitable culture that way. Mm-hmm. Is there a question here?
Yes. You had mentioned the, I think, very insightful comment about having to build a relationship before you go out in the mission field. And you sort of alluded to the two families. I thought of it more of the two churches as well, right? The two elder groups have to have a really strong commitment, a strong understanding mm-hmm. of what that mission is. So is there objective criteria of what we've committed to as far as when you're going to say, okay, we're done, we can come back now?
Mm-hmm.
I can see that being, you know, if you give it very wishy-washy mm-hmm. or up to, like, when I feel like it, there should be some issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is there objective criteria that marks we've completed the mission? I think the short answer is there's not been objective criteria set. It feels so far out in the future. I think because of the level of communication that we'll be having ongoing, there'll be a growing sense of, you know, like, for example, in Malawi, we have a relationship in Malawi, and they have fantastic preachers, growing churches. They're seeking to plant other churches. And before we decided to go to Turkey, it was thought about maybe, you know, my family goes to Malawi, and the immediate pushback was, what am I going to do there? Like, they don't need me there. So I think there'll be a, and, you know, you guys can comment on this as well, there'll be a growing sense of agreement of, you know, the mission's coming to an end, because the goal is not for Paul and I to plant these churches and pastor them until Jesus comes back. The goal is to plant these churches, see qualified men be raised up to lead the churches. They're never going to start in English. They're going to start and stay in Turkish. And the decision will be, okay, where's next? Is it us and our families going, or is it somebody from this church going? So from the very ground up, it'll be a church planting mentality that we plant the churches with. And at what point do we become unnecessary? I think we'll just kind of have a growing sense in the communication that we have with each other. Yeah, there's no plans like we'll be back. We're done in 5 years or 10 years. Mm-hmm. He's selling his house. I'm selling mine. We're divesting ourselves of all our employment, business ownership. So there are no plans to return. We could maybe not come back and live in the United States. So if I think I'll let Paul speak for himself, but as far as my family's concerned, if Turkey becomes evangelized and moves from unreached to reached, where's next? So it's not, you know, we're going to go there and finish and then come back and go back to life as normal. We're really looking at this, you know, there's not ships to burn because we're flying a plane, but the ships are being burnt in the harbor. We're not planning to return. Yeah.
Just to add one thing there, as it pertains to our children, we're not, by the way, forcing our children, our older ones, by the way, to stay either. So if they end up getting married or whatever, it's not, you've got to stay in Turkey. It would be a blessing, but it's not something we're saying has to be the case. I just want to add that in as well.
The relationship between the two churches, their church sent us out 8 years ago to plant about 15 minutes away. And so one of their elders performed my wedding ceremony 28 years ago. We're very close churches. When these two go to Turkey, the remaining four elders, we're meeting together regularly and things like that. So yeah, right. We've been having quarterly, or it's starting to be a little more frequently since they're about to deploy, but we've been getting the churches together at least quarterly to sing and pray and have an update on what's happening.
Um, Yeah, it's. I think Michael alluded to it earlier. It's the number one reason why missions fail. It's not the Muslims or some other, you know, out there problem. It's usually some sort of friction between, you know, a man and another man, or a woman, a wife and wife, and so we've really been focused on that, talking things through, and we've even read parts of Bite and Devour by Alexander Strauch, just to kind of, hey, let's put this in the forefront and keep it something that this is going to happen, because we're in the we're still human, we're going to have these types of problems, so let's talk through what these things are. In terms of complementing each other, you know, one of the things I really appreciate Michael is he's got a real tender care for individuals, you know, just a real carefulness, a humility when he ministers either one-on-one or even when I've watched him preach, a real sincere love for the Lord, and I think there's some real benefits there. He's one of the things I also appreciate, super honest. He asks hard questions as well, which was really, really needful. Hey, what's really going on here? And kind of digging in. And so that's a real benefit as well. And, of course, just the previous experience, I think, that he brings to the table is massive, just in terms of not only being a husband and father, but also some of the things that he's seen being out there and, you know, not just in, say, Syria and Lebanon, but, you know, active in ministry here, abortion clinic and nursing homes and things like that. So there's not a sense of mismatch in that regard at all. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the question, I'll just restate it for anybody listening, is how do we complement each other? Definitely one thing I'm already experiencing with Paul is he's much more disciplined and structured, so that's been a real help to me. That doesn't mean that I'm, you know, a slob and, you know, just wake up, what am I going to do today? But I see Paul really help keep focused and keeping things structured and moving forward. I think that's going to be a real asset to us. Paul, we both do evangelism. He's definitely has a much greater strength in that. So that's also helpful. You know, there may be days that you know, given my natural inclinations, I'd rather just, you know, hang out and do something else. And, you know, I can see this brother saying, hey, let's go out again to the street corner, or go sit at the coffee shop, and let's keep doing this. So those are definitely two things that come to mind. And there's, you know, for our wives as well, there's a lot of complementary relationship going on there where we're already feeling the effects of sharpening each other. You know, most of that's extremely pleasant, and then other parts of it is like, you know, he's not afraid to pull me to the side and say, brother, you know, what are you going to do about this? Or I see this happening, you know, is this pattern, etc. So that's already happening, and boy, what a difference compared to the way both of us were sent to the two respective places that we went. We did not have that, and it is a huge asset.